You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
It is threatened today, threatened by the decision by the United States not to guarantee funding for the IPCC. Therefore, I propose that Europe replaces America, and France will meet that challenge.
If the President of the United States doesn't want to lead the free world, does the President of France fancy his chances? My guests Isabel Hilton and Jacob Parakilis will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including whether or not we should be reassured that the US military appears to regard some presidential orders as open to interpretation, whether or not there's any reason to wonder why Zimbabwe's top general might have visited China shortly prior to unloading his boss, and when photo opportunities go bad. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, the founder and editor of China Dialogue, and Jacob Parakilis, deputy head for the US and the Americas program at Chatham House. Welcome both. Now, since the election of Donald Trump to the US presidency a little over a year ago, there has been much calculation, some of it optimistic, some of it not, about who might step into the vacuum created in various arenas by the United States' dwindling interest in leading things. A partial answer appears to be Europe, in particular France. The president of which, Emmanuel Macron, has confirmed that any shortfall in American funding to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change will be made up for by Europe, and in particular France. Isabel, first of all, how big a deal is this? I mean, how important is the IPCC, and how significant is it that Europe says, well, we'll fund it even if America won't?
It is important. It's not doing raw science, if you like. It's the panel of global scientific advisors to the policy process. So it produces periodic reports, which are essentially drawn from work that has been done in the previous few years, pulls them together and says, this is what's happening with climate change. So it's important. There's always a kind of boondoggle negotiation at the end where, actually, characteristically, the United States would try and get the findings toned down, but they've been pretty central to driving forward the policy agenda. So yes, it matters. What is less easy to substitute, however, is what Trump is doing to the, if you like, the basic science at home. So, for example, the world, you know, finds very useful data from American satellites that monitor, for example, polar ice melt. Those satellites are on the last legs, and there is absolutely no sign that Trump has any interest in funding them. And the Union of Concerned Scientists produced a rather devastating report a few weeks back on what the Trump administration had done to science to date in the United States. So whilst the international, you know, panel could be supported by the willing parties and to the convention, the raw science that is part of what feeds that panel is much more at risk.
Jacob, are we witnessing here the world, you know, a year on from Trump's election, beginning to adjust to the idea that where American leadership would once have been seen as the default setting, it can't be relied upon anymore, and other countries, other, you know, supranational bodies are going to have to start taking their own initiative?
Yes, with a significant asterisk. I mean, I think the idea that France will step in, that Europe will step in and fund IPCC research is important, but there's the basic science issue that Isabel rightly highlighted, and there's also the fact of emissions and of subsidies for industry. I mean, it's all very well and good to understand what's going on, but there actually needs to be action taken in response to it. And part of the problem with the way Trump approaches environmental issues is that the U.S., which sets standards for how governments should subsidize, say, coal versus nuclear versus solar, and if the U.S. is sort of pumping out far more global warming causing pollutants than it was originally planning to, then other countries are going to say, well, this isn't fair. We're having to spend enormous amounts of money to modernize our power and transportation infrastructure. Meanwhile, the U.S. has pulled out. So the really scary scenario is that it sort of sets off a catastrophic arms race of rebuilding the dirty infrastructure.
Just to follow that up, though, Jacob, there is obviously a wider story here about American domestic politics, and it is this disinterest of Donald Trump personally and the Republican Party in particular in the idea of climate change. We have now, as of last week, reached the absurd state where even Syria got around to signing the Paris Climate Agreement. The United States is literally the only country on Earth now that has not signed it. But is that... I don't even know if skepticism is the right word about climate change. It has become an article of faith on the conservative side of American politics. Is there any scientific conviction underpinning this at all? Or have these people just decided that the Democrats believe in climate change, therefore it must be wrong?
I think the problem is that it is this incredibly polarized environment where, climate change has become a partisan issue where it shouldn't be.
Well, everything's become a partisan issue.
Everything has become a partisan issue. The basic functioning of government is a partisan issue. But yeah, you're right. I mean, the Republicans stand out from, the Tories in this country, the, right-wing parties in France and Germany and, in Japan and South Korea. All over the world, even conservative parties are sort of on board with an agenda designed to reduce the impact of human-caused climate change, and the Republicans are fundamentally an outlier on that. And I don't think the cause of that is very easy to determine. I mean, it goes into really, really big questions about sort of what the epistemological boundaries of the debate in the U.S. are.
It does. There is a crude thing about money, of course. Big fossil fuel interests do give large amounts of money to this stuff. But there is no scientific underpinning for this denial. And if there were, they wouldn't have to be scrubbing government websites of climate science. And they are closing it down. They are tearing up decades of climate science, which has been done in the United States, because it doesn't support what they assert, and it never will. So it's a very backwards move. But what's for a ray of light, what's been going on in Bonn this week is this tremendous jamboree of the We Are Still In coalition, which is, California and many other states and big business, and making a very kind of loud and colourful noise. And so it's true that what the federal government does matters. But it doesn't matter as much as you might think. If California sets standards, then anyone who wants to sell to California, and that's a lot of people, have to obey those standards. And California is very much leading the resistance. So, they can certainly do damage. And the loss of America as a convening diplomatic power in the climate diplomacy is a loss. But actually, in terms of emissions, there are a lot of people in the States that are determined that they will meet their Paris pledges regardless.
This is, if I can jump very quickly, and I think it's also important to say that this is not an area where Trump is an outlier. This is an area where I think President Ted Cruz, President Marco Rubio, almost any of the Republican candidates would have had a similar. I mean, there are things that are sort of unique to Trump that sort of have caused concern. But this is an area that's not, it's Trump in line with the general sort of approach to climate issues of the Republican Party. It's not a Trump specialty or a Trump unique characteristic.
But your mention of concerns perhaps unique to Donald Trump does cue up nicely, indeed seamlessly, the next item. So thank you for that, because we will take a closer look at the United States, the Senate of which has this week been examining one of those questions which might have been worth asking before the country elected to its highest office a bellicose game show host no more qualified to hold the position than any given balloon with a face drawn on it. Specifically, what would actually happen if Donald Trump ordered the atomic obliteration of some actual or imagined enemy? Would his orders be instantly and reflexively obeyed, or do America's military commanders think that his outbursts might be open to some measure of interpretation? Jacob, these hearings were interesting at a number of levels. And I wasn't sure, just as I'm not sure what to think about the idea of this popular idea that the United States is now being effectively run by a cabal of unelected generals, which is a prospect I never thought I'd find reassuring, but here we appear to be. General Robert Kaler, retired, the former head of Strategic Command, told the Senate that if he was given an order to launch, which he thought was not right, then he would say, I'm not going to do this. And then when he was asked, well, what would happen then, replied, I'm not really sure.
The problem is that not all nuclear strikes are created equal. If the president, in consultation with his military commanders, in sort of daylight, without the threat of, you know, atomic retaliation, said, you know, I think the only thing that's going to convince the Iranians that we're serious is if we fire a nuke into the heart of Tehran. I'm fairly sure that the generals would say, sir, that's illegal. It violates every precept of the laws of war. We're not going to do it, full stop. You've given us an illegal order and we cannot carry it out.
Because this was the distinction he made. It is perfectly legal to disobey an illegal order.
It is perfectly legal to disobey an illegal order. But the reason why it's important to point out that all nuclear strikes are not the same is because the U.S. operates a launch on warning posture. The U.S. has about 1,500 nuclear weapons distributed between land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles, missiles on submarines that are constantly on patrol in the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, and warheads that can be strapped to bombers and fighter bombers and sent off on their missions. And those systems are designed so that when this network of global warning satellites and radars detects a launch from, well, they were designed for the Soviet Union, but from Russia, from China, from North Korea, that the president can, in a short time, because it only takes about 30 minutes for a ballistic missile to transit from a launch site in Siberia to Washington, D.C., that decision can be made and the missiles can leave their silos within a couple of minutes of the decision being made. And there's simply no space in there for anyone more high ranking than the lieutenant sitting in the bunker in Montana to say, hang on, this is bad. I'm not doing this. This is illegal.
Isabel, is there any argument at all that having these conversations in public, which obviously at one level is entirely admirable, undermines the effectiveness of the deterrent if it allows America's potential enemies to think, maybe they're not serious? Because the thing is, we have no real idea what the protocols that China and Russia operate are.
Well, we do know that there was a man who's my personal hero, who was a Russian military missile operator, who on receiving a signal that the Soviet Union was under attack, declined to retaliate.
This was the colonel based at a Vladivostok listening station,
yeah,
wasn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Otherwise, we just wouldn't be having this conversation.
Well, indeed. This was the man who saw his screens full of dots and just thought, no, can't be right.
I'm not going to do it. And he didn't do it. So you know, it is possible that human beings intervene in this insane process. I think having the conversation, I mean, honestly, Donald Trump is such a worrying figure. That's a very worrying finger on the button, that to have these conversations in public, I find personally reassuring. And I don't think it would encourage anyone to launch an unprovoked attack on the United States simply because there might be a 10-minute delay in retaliation. I think, you know, deterrence is deterrence. And the United States is so extraordinarily well equipped with the capacity to retaliate that you'd be mad to launch an attack. And that, I think, that deterrence holds.
It would require an adversary capable of launching an attack so big, it knocked out 450 silo-based ICBMs, yeah, 3 to 4 Ohio-class ballistic missile submarines hiding in the deepest, quietest parts of the ocean and
there
air bases. There's no enemy that can do that.
There is no enemy. So there is no fear, I think, of a first strike against the United States unless it's, you know, somebody with a dirty bomb in Manhattan, you know.
That gets us into a different realm of
completely
non-state
different, exactly.
Actors. But Jacob, is it... If it's unimaginable, and I think it is for the reasons that Isabel just described, a first strike against the United States, are we coming around to the conclusion that a first nuclear strike by the United States is also verging on the unimaginable? Because it is incredibly difficult, or it's beyond me anyway, to think of circumstances in which you would get a president and the people around him agreeing that this was a legitimate and proportionate response.
And this is
it's not a response, a legitimate and proportionate action.
And this is where it gets very tricky, because is the U.S., under the rubric of modernization, has been sort of improving the capabilities of its nuclear weapons, particularly with the, I think it's the 12 variant of the B-61 tactical nuclear bomb, designed to penetrate into the Earth and destroy deeply buried targets. And it could be that in the event that the U.S. identified, say, a North Korean nuclear weapons bunker, that the Pentagon would say, we've assessed, and the only way that we can be 100% assured of taking out this target is to use a B-61-12, to use a nuclear first strike. And the U.S. has never had a no first strike policy, because the way nuclear posture was set up during the Cold War was that NATO couldn't win a conventional war in Europe. So NATO had to have a nuclear first strike posture in this way of thinking in order to deter Soviet armored columns from just driving straight through to Paris.
That was also the concern when there was a discussion, again, in the 70s and 80s about battlefield nukes, because it lowered the threshold for the use of nuclear weapons, and then you open up the possibility of escalation. But as long as we're not there, it's still a very big decision.
But just a final thought on this, Jacob, because it was the obvious point that a lot of people leapt to when the prospect of a Trump presidency grew more and more realistic. Do you actually think it's any more or less likely that the United States would launch a nuclear weapon now than it was this time, you know, a year ago?
I don't know, and that's the really frightening thing. And the thing is that I think someone as unpredictable as Trump, someone who doesn't have a record in public service that we can point to, somebody who certainly has spent a long time building up this character, this over-the-top character, who's expressed views about nuclear weapons that no other American politician anywhere near that level of power has expressed. You know, even if the danger goes from 1% to 3%, because this is such a massive, significant action, that's a huge change. And I don't know if the danger has gone from 1% to 3%. I don't know if it's gone from 3% to 20%. I mean, these things are by definition impossible to quantify. And that uncertainty is very, very frightening.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, Isabel Hilton and Jacob Parakilis. Coming up next, is there a Chinese connection to the demise of Robert Mugabe?
This Christmas, alongside established Monocle favourites to place under the tree, why not treat your friends and loved ones to some of our new collaborations? A truly fragrant festive treat comes courtesy of Monocle Alpine by Trez. Our friends from Sud Tirol have developed a line of products from shampoo to face cream that will transport you to the serene surroundings of northern Italy. Combining sleek, lightweight design with robust Spanish workmanship, the items in the Monocle Leather Collection are produced and manufactured in collaboration with Comme des Garçons. We've also teamed up with the US brand Topo to rework a selection of their classic pieces. Topo have fused traditional style with modern functionality to develop rucksacks and pouches made using Cordura nylon fabric and a coated pack cloth lining. And they're available exclusively to Monocle. So happy shopping and a very happy Christmas from everyone at Monocle.
You are back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Isabel Hilton and Jacob Parakilis. Now, latest reports from Zimbabwe are that Robert Mugabe, who now appears to be the ex-president of the country, is negotiating with emissaries from South Africa vis-a-vis his retirement options. The 93-year-old was placed under house arrest by Zimbabwe's military yesterday. Some reports suggest he is insisting that he's still in charge. Other observers have noted the perhaps interesting fact that the chief of the Zimbabwe Defence Forces, General Constantine Gieva Chiwenga, was in Beijing as recently as last week. Isabel, there's been, you know, much hastened attempts to point out that, you know, chiefs of defence forces do not just flit about on a whim. This visit was arranged some time ago and so forth. The two countries do have a long-standing relationship. Is it possibly a coincidence that one week he's in Beijing, the next week he's placed the president under house arrest?
I think that...
I mean, we all have funny ideas on long flights. I mean,
I think, but, you know, this could be an idea that matured on a long flight. And on arrival in Beijing, had he not mentioned it, I think it would have been extremely remiss. So there he is. He's in Beijing. Things are coming to a head in Zimbabwe.
Because, again, on the subject of things that don't just happen, I don't think he just woke up one day this week and thought,
I think I'll overthrow the government.
No,
I think it was coming. And I think that they obviously had to tell the Chinese. And they had to give the Chinese some reassurance. The Chinese would not have told them not to do it because they, you know, all they want to know is, are my investments safe? Are you going to do something about this indigenization policy? And, you know, are you guys still going to be in power?
Well, is all
of those points, I think they probably got some reassurance.
Is that the likeliest scenario then? Not that General Chiwenga was going to Beijing to receive instructions so much as to ask permission?
I think to ask permission to keep them informed. I'm not sure that they would proactively have ordered him to overthrow Mugabe, and I think if they were to do that, they would do it rather more quietly and subtly than in the course of a very public visit. So who knows, neither of us were there, but I don't think that the Chinese have proactively instigated any such move in their long history of interference in other people's countries. They do like to be kept informed, and they do like a few guarantees, particularly when they've got a lot at stake, as they have in Zimbabwe.
Well, Jacob, China has, of course, invested substantially in Zimbabwe, as it has across Africa, but when China expands overseas and when China invests overseas, do we get any sense at all that they are seeking to export their revolution in the way that the United States always has? America has a thing of trying to bring what it perceives as the best of America to the places in which it, you know, interferes or intervenes at whatever level. But all other things considered, does China really care one way or the other who runs Zimbabwe?
It doesn't seem to me that the Chinese have the same kind of forward-leaning placement of values in their engagements as the United States has. Now, of course, the way the U.S. Instigated those, the way the U.S. puts its values into effect in its foreign policy has always been, let's say, massively inconsistent. There are countries in which it's pulled very hard for democracy. There have been countries where it's pulled very hard against democracy, you know, Central America being rife with instances where the U.S. has sort of supported military governments largely in the name of anti-communism and, you know, certainly did its fair share in Africa as well. My sense is that the way that the Chinese government has approached these kind of engagements is much more economically led and much more agnostic about the system of government. That may change over time, but I think for the moment they're taking a different approach. Of course, where China is in the world sort of power structure is different to where the U.S. was in regards to the world power structure for the last 70 years.
Well, I think back in the day when China had a clearer idea of what its revolution was, it did try to export it. It did support Mugabe when he was a anti-colonial resistance.
And of course, North Korea and North Vietnam closer to home.
Yes, but these days, you know, which revolution are you trying to export if you're China? You're pretty confused about what that consists of. But what you do want is to buy influence. You want friends around the world, and you want a stable investment, what's the word?
Environment
will do.
Landscape.
Right.
So they milieu.
Exactly. So they've got diamond mines. They've got tobacco farms. They don't want trouble. They don't. And I think that they may have got to the point. If you remember, there were riots against Mugabe last year, and the Chinese kind of sat on their hands because they were quite cross with Mugabe for the moves against foreign ownership of companies worth more than $500,000 in Zimbabwe, and that affects a lot of Chinese companies. And they were very unhappy about that. So they may have recognized that this was a disintegrating regime, and, you know, been very happy to receive a proposition that it might stabilize if Mugabe could be put into the old folks' home.
Final brief thought on this one, Jacob, and it is possibly slightly glib thought to find oneself entertaining about a military coup, which is not usually a desirable turn of events. Is it possible that this might not end up being an altogether bad thing for Zimbabwe?
I think it's really difficult to to ever endorse a military coup. I mean, I think, you know, that they're certainly, you know, without defending Mugabe in any way, it is quite difficult to find historical antecedents for coups that have promptly turned power back over to the people and produced a democratic upsurge. I mean, I suppose anything's possible, but I'm very, very skeptical of the idea that coups are likely to produce anything except a furtherance of a different type of autocratic governance.
Okay. Well, finally tonight, it is manifestly unfair that any public figure, especially in the modern age, can be defined by a single photographic image. When someone is photographed often enough, it's easy to find one frame that makes them look ridiculous. It happens nevertheless. Here in the UK, the once promising political careers of the Brothers Miliband were effectively ended by a banana and a bacon sandwich, and we now await posterity's judgment on US Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, whose name I don't think I've ever learned to pronounce properly. Was that right, Mnuchin?
Mnuchin. It's almost silent.
Near enough.
It looks like a misprint.
Near enough. Let's just call him Steve Misprint. He has been photographed holding a sheet of dollar bills, accompanied for some reason by his wife, who was dressed for some reason as a strangler. Isabel, first of all, the photo itself, if you're the Treasury Secretary of the United States and you get the first sheet of bills with your signature on it, that's quite an exciting moment. That's a reasonable thing to be photographed holding.
Absolutely.
So that's fine. It's what the hell else is going on?
Well,
in this picture,
it's the fact that they're deeply unpopular. They're rich. It's the fact that his wife, you know, honestly, why was she there at all? I mean, she's not a Treasury official,
yes,
and she's noted for her, you know, love of material things. So I think the kind of it was just tactfully put. Yes, quite. It was just a bit of a car crash, you know, and the black gloves certainly didn't help.
Yes, speaking on behalf of your entire nation, Jacob,
as I so often do.
as you so often are called upon to do when sitting in that chair, how do you feel about this?
I think it was a pretty bad mistake. I think, and it's, you know, if it had been sort of first week jitters, fine, fair enough. This is not the first time Steve and Louise Mnuchin have been pictured, have engaged improperly with sort of their public role. There was the Instagram photo of them getting off a military plane to visit Fort Knox for some reason. It was never entirely clear why, where she tagged all the brands that she was wearing and then engaged, I would say, abrasively with someone who commented.
I do also commend to listeners, if you've got a spare few minutes, go online and investigate Ms. Mnuchin's literary career, which her excursion into travel writing.
Not to mention her film career.
And
she
her
was
film career.
A minor part in the TV movie of the romance of the prince of the the royal couple.
Was she really?
Yes.
Oh, I shall look out for that. But I did want to talk about photo opportunities gone wrong, Isabel, because you can take an embarrassing photograph of literally anybody. If you take enough shots of them, you'll get one. For one to stick, does it need to reinforce an idea of that person that already exists?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the banana and the bacon sandwich were unfortunate.
But it was that thing, was David Miliband was always seen as a bit of a geek, and Ed Miliband
absolutely
possibly an even bigger geek.
Indeed.
And so
it reinforced it. But if you think, for example, there was that picture of Thatcher against the background of an industrial wasteland. Do you remember that one? somewhere up north where, you know, she had pretty much closed down all economic activity, and she was photographed against this background, and I think God knows what she thought she, you know, that was going to say to people. But it just looked as though she'd laid waste to the entire region and didn't seem to mind. There was no one else in the picture. It was fairly extraordinary.
Well, of course, and more recently we've had that one of Theresa May sitting alone, looking mournful at a table, and there was, you know, obviously an innocent explanation was that she just happened to sit down first. But there it was. Do you have any particular favourites, Jacob?
I think you have to give credit to the classic, Mike Dukakis, governor of Massachusetts. Nice, thoughtful, decent man, on top of an M1 Abrams tank wearing a very doofy-looking soft helmet with his name awkwardly printed on the front, smiling. And to be fair, when you're sitting on top of a 70-ton war machine grinding through the mud, you might be quite happy, but the sort of his total out-of-placeness and his slightly uncomfortable with how much he was enjoying himself grin and the doofy helmet, just it was a spectacular misfire.
There was also the one which the unfortunate John Gummer has never managed to live down, of giving a hamburger to his daughter in the course of the BSE outbreak. He's actually quite a nice man, but it sort of said quite a lot about what people thought about Tories.
There was, I do remember all sorts of responses of that about these people feeding us various things and expect us to consume it, and so forth. On that happy, nostalgic note, that is the end of today's show. Isabel Hilton and Jacob Parakilis, thanks for joining us. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Rapello, researched by Gaia Lutz and Alessio Dallana. Our studio manager was David Stevens. There's more music next. 1900, Andrew Tuck is in with The Urbanist. The Daily is back with more on the day's big stories at 2200. I'll be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. Until then, thanks for listening. We'll